We interrupt this program to bring you an important Wayfair message. Wayfair's got style tips for every home. This is Nicole Byer, helping you make those rooms flyer. Today's style tip, when it comes to making a statement, treat bold patterns like neutrals. Go wild! Like an untamed animal print area rug under a rustic farmhouse table from Wayfair.com. Ooh, fierce! This has been your Wayfair style tip to keep those interiors superior.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
You just realized your business needed to hire someone yesterday. How can you find amazing candidates fast? Easy. Just use Indeed. Stop struggling to get your job post seen on other job sites. With Indeed sponsored jobs, your post jumps to the top of the page for your relevant candidates, so you can reach the people you want faster. According to Indeed data, sponsored jobs posted directly on Indeed have 45% more applications than non-sponsored jobs. Don't wait any longer. Speed up your hiring right now with Indeed. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/PODKATZ13. Just go to Indeed.com/PODKATZ13 right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Terms and conditions apply. Hiring? Indeed is all you need.
Welcome to the Gravity Podcast, where we host conversations on developing a Christian spirituality rooted in love that fosters resilient faith in everyday life.
Hey.
Hey.
This is the
hey. Sort of spilled out of your mouth.
I haven't spoken much yet today. I stayed up late last night watching a NBA finals game.
Basketball
unbelievable.
Game. Yes.
Did you watch that game, Christy?
I sure did with my kids. We were screaming.
Yeah.
So I have a confession. I am been a Pacers fan my whole life, growing up in Indiana, et cetera, Reggie Miller, you know, all that. And the game, the Pacers looked awful last night.
They did.
They looked like a high school team playing a professional team. They turned the ball over. They couldn't do anything. And I sort of just was resigned to like ride out the game. So I'm like, I'm on Reddit. I'm reading, 50 years and older nutritional advice. You know, I'm trying to get the aches and pains, the various ones in my body to abate because I've been sitting in the same position for a long time. And my wife and my son are watching the game. They're like, you got to get off your phone and watch this. And I dialed in the last, several minutes of the game. I was watching the whole thing, but I dialed in. When Halliburton hit that shot, my wife screamed at the television in a way that I have never seen her in my life. Christy, you know Sharon well.
Oh, yeah.
Ben, you guys should meet someday. Mm-hmm. You and my wife. And she lost it, was jumping up and down, clutching her fists, squatting like she needed to go in the woods. Like, it was crazy.
Listener, just in case you're confused, this was the first game of the NBA Finals. We're recording this on the Friday after the first game of the NBA Finals on Thursday. There's another game on Sunday. We have no idea how that one's going to go,
right,
but this episode is going to be already released. So just, exult with us in the Friday afterglow.
Yes.
Of the first game of the NBA Finals. It was really incredible. When the Halliburton has hit so many of those shots during this yes. playoff run. One of the shots that he hit, Deb and I were watching the game, and I literally just I got up from the couch and ran into the kitchen. Like, I didn't know what else to do to kind of like get the energy out. And my wife was telling one of her friends about this, and it was just like, yeah, just Ben ran into the kitchen. And the friend was like, oh, he got the zoomies. I was like, yep, I got the zoomies.
So Christy, you're watching it sort of as a dispassionate person,
yeah.
right? You're not really a Thunder or a Pacers fan.
No. But it's super fun when stuff like that happens in the last few seconds like, the team that's been down, whatever. So
yeah, Halliburton's on a heater. That guy is hitting... He's 8 of 9.
That's crazy.
On game-winning shots this year.
That's crazy.
Clutch.
He's hit five in the last go-ahead shots in the last few seconds, which is like second all-time to LeBron.
It's so fun to watch. It's so entertaining.
It's crazy.
Oh, my goodness.
Yeah.
They had no business. If I was a Thunder fan, I would have been waking up this morning thinking, how did we lose that game?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
How did we lose it?
I don't think they led the whole game until they won the game.
Right.
Yeah.
That was the first lead they took, wasn't it?
They led the game for 0.3 seconds.
Right.
And that's all it took. That's the only time that matters.
Yep.
This just in case you were unaware, listener, the Gravity Commons podcast is becoming a sports podcast for the next couple of weeks. No, I'm just joking. It's not.
I still think that the Thunder will win. They're just an incredible defensive team. They didn't shoot the ball well. If they shoot the ball well, we lose.
Yeah.
Anyway, it's nice for Indiana to have something, just something.
Yes. Yes.
You know,
we've had several this playoff run. It's been fun, very fun.
You know, something
into basketball.
On the topic of something, reminded that Christy, you've spent the last week or so in the Dominican Republic.
Great segue.
Yeah, I realized like I haven't seen you guys in a while. Mm-hmm. I feel like my kid graduated high school. Like there's lots of things that happened, mm-hmm. but I was in the Dominican Republic, and it was so fun. And I love the DR. I love the people. I love what God is doing over there in and through the people. And it was fun to be able to kind of partner and be able to see firsthand up close what's going on.
Nice. Yeah. What did you do? Can you give us a little summary?
Yeah, we worked at Pico Escondido, which is like a Young Life camp in the middle of the country. And we helped make a pickleball court, which is kind of cool. And then we did homestays. Like I took 15 high school kids. And so they have to know what it's like to live in the DR and speak Spanish and how life is different there and just befriend people and learn from people and that type of thing. And that is, I've known the people there for 13 years. And so there's a lot of buy-in relationally to actually have real deep conversations. And I, about ministry and learning from each other and growing and asking questions and, while my Spanish isn't awesome, like somehow we're able to communicate to actually have deep conversations. So I love it.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
That's very cool.
That's awesome. Well, we have an interview with Danny Bryant to get to, but before we do, I think I want to play a little game with you.
Oh.
Okay.
We're going to do a vocab quiz.
Mm. Oh, dear.
And this is a vocab quiz of Gen Alpha slang.
Oh, boy.
Okay.
okay.
All of us have Gen Alpha and Gen Z. People in our lives that we love, and they speak a different language.
Yeah.
They do.
And so in order for us to continue to have communication and stay in relationship with them, we need to learn their language. So listener, this is for all of us, but here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to give you a gen. We're just going to do three words this time.
Okay.
I'm going to give you the word, and you're going to say your name.
Wait.
That's how you buzz in.
Okay.
You say your name, and then you tell me what you think the word means, and you have to use it in a sentence with that meaning. All right?
Oh, this is great.
Okay.
And each of you will get a chance, but the person who says their name first goes first, all right?
Okay.
The first word is GYAT.
Like G-Y-A-T? I think I've seen that.
Christy.
Yeah.
All right, Christy.
Yeah.
That girl's got a big GYAT.
What's the definition? What's the definition, though?
Christy, what would be the definition then? Would that be a goiter?
Yeah.
Is it a word for a goiter?
Mole? Yep.
I think it's butt.
A gyat is a butt?
Gyat.
Gyat isn't. Go ahead, Ben.
Well,
do you have
I feel like I should get a chance to also buzz in.
Yeah, you do.
Right? Because that doesn't feel right to me. It doesn't feel like a gyat. I don't think it's a noun. I think it. Okay, so gyat. I think it's an exclamation.
Nope.
I think it's an exclamation.
I disagree.
Okay. Where it would be...
Let's find out. Wait, can you use it in a sentence?
A sentence would be like, when Halliburton hit that shot, I was like, yeah! Doesn't sound right now that I say it.
No, okay. No. Matt, right. Tell us.
All right, well, you are both correct.
Oh.
All right, so technically, yeah, is a shortened version of a curse word. Like a very slang way to say GD.
Oh,
dang!
Gosh darn it!
But yes, gosh darn it! But it actually has taken on, it was popularized by somebody looking at the caboose mm-hmm. of a female mm-hmm. and exclaiming appreciation for it. And typically that caboose was on the larger size.
Okay, so my sentence made sense.
Okay, so your sentence makes sense, Christy.
And so does mine.
And this is how slang works, though. It starts as a particular meaning, mm-hmm. and then it becomes has a larger semantic range.
Right.
So this is what Google AI says. Gyat is an exclamation used to express strong excitement, surprise, or admiration, particularly in response to seeing someone with a shapely butt.
Nice.
Okay, we both win. 1-1. 1-1.
All right. I will admit that I was not looking at Halliburton's butt when I exclaimed that. I was just looking at the shot going in. So,
I expect you to use "Gyat" several times in game two on Sunday.
Yeah, I'm gonna do it.
All right. Word number two. Remember to buzz in with your name.
Yep.
Ben, you started talking, that's not part of the rules.
I wanted some clarification.
No, there's no clarification.
Oh, okay.
Because in the real world, when you're hanging around a Gen Alpha,
you can't.
Maybe you go to a Gen Alpha
convention zoo, yeah.
And you want to feed them.
Oh my gosh.
You need to. You don't get a chance to ask questions because they're just using words at you.
Okay.
Yeah. You got to be on your feet. All right.
Life.
You can't. Unless you want their eyes to roll out of their head.
Right, and that's bad for them. So that's
bad for them. All right, number two, Riz.
Ben.
Oh gosh, yes. Biden didn't say my name.
All right,
Riz. Say my name.
Short for charisma. So you might say something like, yeah, that Halliburton sure has Riz.
Okay, I think my sentence is better.
Okay.
What would you agree with the definition?
I think it comes from charisma, but I think it's like hitting on or like going after. And so I would say Paul's got Riz. Paul's like something about like for me, like I would be like, oh, he's risen on me.
Risen. So it's a verb as well as an adjective.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Like hitting on you or like liking you or whatever.
Okay.
Yeah. Good. You both are right. It is short for charisma. Mm-hmm. Right, it's a slang term meaning a person's ability to attract romantic interest, charm, or seduce someone. It means like a game or charisma. But it also so like for instance, using it in a sentence, Matt Tebbe has mad riz, but his wife doesn't even care one bit. Mm. If I'm just spitballing. Yeah,
as an example sentence that has no bearing in reality.
But you wouldn't say a basketball player has Riz because of his playing ability. Doesn't it have to do with like a relationship?
Yeah, it usually has to do with somebody's like game or like.
Well, that's what I meant. That's how I think about Halliburton. It's like, he's a player.
Was he trying to seduce SGA or Gardner?
Well, you know.
I think I get a half a point. I think, Ben, you don't get a point for that. I'm going to say,
What?
I'll give you a half point, Ben, because it was short for words.
Charisma, noun, I guess.
There's an entire lexicon around Riz. There's the Rizzler.
Right.
YOLO McRizinator, you know, Rizzly
that's
Bear.
I don't think that's
Abraham.
Right. I don't think
Abraham
that's
Abraham Link Riz. No, you know, there's like the Rizosaurus Rex. There's all kinds of.
Oh, man. No,
that's not true.
Yeah.
None of that's true.
No. It is true. Barack, Rizbama. There's just a lot of ways to do to mix Riz in there. All right. Final word today, because I've got a list of a lot.
Okay.
We'll get to these later. Yeah. But the final word today. Remember to use your name.
Yep.
Christy. Use now I feel words. Like I have to remind
use
you of
your
this.
Words, Christy.
I know. Use my words.
Is skibbity.
Christy.
Ben. Christy. I'm buzzing in with Christy's
name. Something happens and you say skibbity toilet.
Yeah, but that's not a definition.
I didn't give a definition. I gave it use
right, Ben,
sentence.
I'm buzzing in.
Use it, that's a sentence.
Yes.
Well,
but what does it
something
mean?
Happens
doesn't even mean anything. Something happens and you say it. You say a word. Something happens
with
and you
toilet.
Say
toilet.
Yeah.
You have to say skibbity toilet.
Skibbity toilet.
Together.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
I'm going to buzz in.
Okay, go ahead.
I think skibbity means it's a synonym of sketchy, like something that's like not quite right. It's like, that's really bad, skibbity. Like that person's vibe is off. They're super skibbity. That's how I think you use it.
Okay.
But I feel like it's like morphed into our society.
It's probably one of those things that where everybody's correct. Every word means everything in this game, it seems like.
That's fair. Yeah. Okay, Matt, so
skibbity,
tell us.
Yeah, all right. Skibbity, yes.
So like a lot of Gen Alpha slang, this is something that originated with a streamer.
Yeah, I mean, they have like millions of like views.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Of like a toilet guy and like army people. And people like guy and army millions people? Of people watch this video.
Yeah. Okay. So these words sometimes are created by people who are making viral memes or shows. And then, people we'll talk about brain rot later, but people watch these things and then they repeat these little verbal memes. So skibbity initially meant something like dumb or awkward.
Or sketchy,
but it's the semantic range has expanded. It can be a word to describe something amazing or fantastic.
Yeah.
It can be used to describe something chaotic or random or hilarious.
You can kind of use it for anything you want.
Yeah. So it can be used more generally to describe something as cool, bad, or dumb, often paired with other words. Like you could say like skibbity riz.
Skibbity riz.
Oh. What about skibbity toilet?
You can say skibbity toilet. I don't know if anybody says that.
Middle school boys do.
They did for the like 10 minutes.
The thing about Gen Alpha slang, though, is that it really is a flash in the pan.
That's true.
So if I try to use a word that I learned...
yesterday.
Yeah. And it's already passé. But I do feel like these three words continue to be used. So skibbity is like when we would say, that's dope. Mm-hmm. Or that's cool.
Yep.
You know? Okay. But it also can be like hilarious or awkward.
Okay.
All right.
That's a super wide range of meanings that it feels like a meaningless word.
It is.
It's basically, it sounds like it's a word that you say to indicate that you know how to be cool.
Yeah.
You're sort of like signaling to the world, I'm a certain kind of person of a certain age, and I understand how this
it's
works.
It's kind of like telling the world I'm skippity.
It's virtue signaling.
Right. Virtue signaling.
Oh, gosh.
Well, speaking of virtue signaling.
Mm-hmm.
Nope. That was a bad segue. Maybe it is.
Riz.
Okay, so virtue signaling is part of the whiteness gospel.
Oh.
Hey. Oh, there you go. So, there you go.
Anyway, we are talking, let's pivot into this interview. This was a great interview. Christy, you weren't on this, but you should have been.
I
hope
I'm
you feel bad
here.
About this.
No,
I'm just kidding. That's also part of the whiteness gospel. Part of the whiteness gospel is being a deputy of shame, which we talk about in this interview with Danny Bryant. He wrote a book called Unless a Seed Falls to the Ground, Welcoming the Death of the Whiteness Gospel. We're talking about hospice care and how the white American church might need to go into hospice care because we've believed a version of the gospel that is too tangled up in whiteness to be saved. Anyway, it's a bit of a serious topic, but this was a great book and really enjoyed talking with Danny. Danny Bryant serves as a priest at St. Mary of Bethany Parish, as a spiritual director with the Center for Hope and Healing, and as athletic director at Independence Academy in Middle Tennessee. He is also a co-founder of the Black Mental Health Counselor Reparations Foundation. Danny is passionate about seeking practical, just, and merciful healing in the world and enjoys life with his wife and four children and is a delight to talk to. Let's get into this interview. Danny Bryant, welcome to the Gravity Commons podcast.
Thanks so much. Good to be here.
I know we just read an intro for you, but in addition to being the author of the book that we want to talk about today, you are a friend of Matt's and mine. And we've gotten to know you a little bit sort of asynchronously online over the last several years. But we got a chance to meet up this past, was it April? It was just April. That was like less than a month ago as we were recording this at the Post Evangelical Collective, which was lovely. It was great to meet you.
Same. Anyway, yeah. It's great to finally in person. I think we've even done a podcast together way back.
That's right. We did. Yes.
Yeah.
Matt and I share a lot of similar history to Danny. And so, you know, let the listener understand.
Yeah.
Talk about these things. But yeah, it's great to have you. Maybe, you know, I know your bio says what it says about you, but probably most of our listeners are unfamiliar with you. And so, I don't know, like what, say a little bit about yourself, like where you're at, what you get up to. I don't know.
Yeah. I think that my, you know, maybe deepest passion in life is just helping people get free from whatever may imprison us. For me, the book certainly talks a lot about why that grew and formed in my life, being born into a cult and leaving, but just really living life aware of where we are bound individually or collectively, and figuring out how to get out of those bindings and be free. So I think whatever I'm doing, there's a piece of that in the mix, and it's probably what I enjoy doing the most, and so trying to find healthy expressions of the need to be free is what keeps me going.
I love that. You know, you talked about growing up in a cult, and one of the things I was struck by in your book is how much of your own story is in this book. It doesn't quite read like a memoir, of course, because you're talking about kind of other things. But there's a ton of your story in the book from, as you said, being born into a cult to then working at a Presbyterian church and then becoming an Anglican priest. And I was struck by, like, along the way, you notice these commonalities in between all these groups, even though the theologies are different, obviously. But there's these commonalities within the group that that led you to become aware of something that you end up in the book calling the whiteness gospel.
Yeah.
So anyway, I wonder if you can just, you know, what do you mean by whiteness? And then what is the whiteness gospel? Like, what is that? What's the good news? I'm putting that in scare quotes.
Yeah.
Like, what's the good news of whiteness that is so seductive for us? Like, how do you define the whiteness gospel?
I think the seduction is it always leaves us in charge. And, you know, one of the stories I tell is about the first professional development day when I was an elementary school teacher at the Covenant School here in Nashville. And the pastor who was the main engine of starting that school used a grammar lesson in our first professional development day where he said the V in the Covenant School is an article. And it was important for us to understand the V wasn't modifying school, it was the covenant. And this was going to be a school that carried the covenant. And then we talked about Genesis 15, and we, this like school of like 35 kids and in one of the wealthiest parts of Nashville, was carrying the covenant that the Jews had abandoned. Day two was our crest was going to be the Harvard motto, Veritas Christo et Ecclesia, that they began with and had dropped, you know, for Christ in the church, and was just Veritas. And so literally this like startup school in Nashville, Tennessee was carrying the covenant that the Jews had abandoned and the covenant that the Puritan Harvard University had abandoned. So there's just this theme in every group I've been in, we start over, we recover some purity that somebody abandoned, and now we're in charge of it. And it's going to be okay because we're at the steering wheel. And so whether it was the cult that was believed it was restoring something, the Churches of Christ that I was part in more as a student in schools than the churches, and you know, the PCA, the ACNA, it's this thing and it's just insatiable. It can't stop. And it was the launch of this country, you know, a city on a hill. It's what we had on the little coffee mugs that we gave to the first year families at Covenant. We'll be a city on a hill. And that that addiction to being the standard in the world is whiteness. Like, that's not always white skin color. That's always not always pigmentation. It's this assimilation project in the world. And so this, you get to participate in the resources when you assimilate. And that, I think, is the heart of whiteness. James Baldwin calls it the price of the ticket and describes, you know, each people group that comes here and becomes white, or doesn't, or can't, or won't. And that, I think, leads to so much of the discord we find ourselves in right now.
Yeah. That's why we started a podcast, because we're going to do it right. You know,
you're right.
recovering the right way to use words, and we get to be in charge of it. So
has anybody, somebody look up if Podcast on a Hill exists? On a Hill. Start that one.
I might do that right now. So.
We'll be right back. The Gravity Podcast is sponsored by the Gravity Formation Course, a 12-month cohort-based training in practical spiritual formation, where you'll learn to notice how God is already at work in your life so you can participate more fully in the life God shares with us. It's a discipleship process that goes beyond just gaining more knowledge and trying new practices. In the Gravity Formation Course, we go below the surface of our lives so that we can notice and name our deepest desires in God's presence, and to discern how God is at work in those desires to lead us towards holistic flourishing. More transformation, more life, more joy, more love. We've trained hundreds of people all over the world in this formation framework, and it has helped many people to have a sense of God at work in their lives, to learn how to be more at home in God's love. If you'd like to learn more, go to gravitycommons.com/formation.
Let's get back to the show. This person on what used to be known as Twitter, that I still call Twitter, as a small piece of protest, was saying, like, ruminating on why Donald Trump is so popular among young men. And his thesis was because Donald Trump gets to be always right.
Yes.
He's never wrong, ever. And so many people feel so threatened by being told that they're wrong about things, which feels like an existential threat, right? Uh-huh. You know, it's like, I have to apologize for being a man. I have to apologize for being white. And what you're describing then isn't, it's not a threat to my person. It's a threat to the supremacy system inside of which I live and move and have my being. Uh-huh. Because one of the things you talk about is that whiteness is just the way the world is.
Right.
It doesn't need our intent. It doesn't need our consent. It just is. Can you name a few ways? So I just named one, right? This, if we're wrong, we're somehow being violated. Uh-huh. Because whiteness affords us the privilege of always being right. Can you name a few other ways that the whiteness gospel shows up in common assumptions and practices, even in the church?
I think authority structures, one of the... I love to play with movies and songs and quotes throughout the book. And it's Jack Nicholson in A Few Good Men, this Colonel Jessup spirituality that's like, you want me on that wall, you need me on that wall. And it, when we live thinking that the person on the wall is why we're safe, rather than us being in communion with each other, I think we're heading in the direction of the strong man. We're heading in the direction of needing the person on the wall. Eddie Glaude writes about how many sins have been placed under the lie of a more perfect, that phrase. And yes. So if the United States is the, we're not perfect, but we're the closest thing there's ever been. So there's going to be some bodies buried. But we are right on the edge of this thing breaking open and humanity being what it was made to be. And that can be an Anglican bishop who leaves the Episcopal Church and now he's our Colonel Jessup, or that could be whoever, right? It could be a podcast. Like, I think you, the three of us, we really have to make sure we're not telling people, you want us on that wall, you need us on that wall. I think the Revelation passage, that what we are claiming is a city whose gates never shut. So we don't need anybody on the wall. We don't need, as you know, chapter I don't know, three or four called deputies of shame in unlimited surveillance. We don't need to deputize or be deputized yes. to carry the shame. And there's no shame in being wrong. It's to be human. Mm-hmm. It's to learn together. You all know stuff I don't know. Yeah. You have experiences I don't have. And so you know things I can learn from you. And what a joy, right? To be mm-hmm. part of the human collective that learns from one another. I think, yeah, we need to ask Colonel Jessup to step down off the wall and come to Eucharist on Sunday. We'll see what
happens. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
I'm not sure Colonel Jessup can handle that truth.
Yeah. Crystal. Yeah.
There is, by the way, I didn't find Podcast on a Hill, but there's a lot of podcasts named City on a Hill.
There you go.
So anyway.
Somebody needs to.
There we are. Yeah. So I wanted to ask you about that chapter that you mentioned, because that was a feature of whiteness. You call it surveillance. And you use this, you use the tulip metaphor from Calvinism to kind of talk about some of the features of whiteness. And so I think that's the L. No, that's the
U, unlimited surveillance.
Unlimited surveillance. And so the concept of surveillance as part of whiteness was interesting to me. And I wonder if you can talk a little bit more about that. And also the fact that it, that whiteness creates, in order to complete this kind of project of surveillance, whiteness creates something you call deputies of shame to kind of keep people in line. Can you talk a bit about how that works?
Yeah. So the story I think I maybe used pretty early in that one is when I was a little boy, I walked up to a man at a Greyhound. I mean, like little, like this is like four or five. There was a man at a Greyhound bus station smoking a cigarette. And I named the cult leader Brother Sentry in the book, not his real name, but I walked up to this complete stranger, 4 or 5 years old, and told him, Brother Sentry says not to smoke. And that was told the cult leader. I don't remember that. The reason I remember that is I remember the cult leader talking about it publicly. And I was his deputy of shame. No one knew who he was. Nobody cared who he was, but it was my job to carry the shame that he put on people who smoke out into the world. That, you know, I follow that through my time in the PCA or my time in the ACNA and what we were ordained to be. We were ordained to be cops. The chapter before that,
yes.
Total Mediocrity, is called Jedi, or what is it?
Stormtroopers
who are called, think they're Jedis. And yeah. And my ordination, the guy who preached was like telling me that I was like Luke and Han. And these years later, it's like I was made a stormtrooper that night. I was there to keep the Empire rolling and to put the shame where the people above me told me to put the shame. So this deputy to say, this is what we have to think about LGBTQ folks. This is what we have to think about the legality of abortion. This is what we have to think about the authority of the Bible. And it shuts down any kind of creativity, and it puts people in the shackles of the insular economy that I found myself in, and so many of us, I think, found ourselves in.
Yeah, I think that's a good example of the common sense, how whiteness presents itself to us as just the way things are. That there's an assumption in that bus station that of course it's your responsibility to police that man smoking.
Mm-hmm. It's for him, right? I'm doing it for him.
It's an act of love inside that world, right? Yeah.
And I think once you begin to just bring a little, for me it was a gentle interrogation of the impulse to police. That started to unravel things for me. I wonder if you could talk more about this metaphor of cancer, Danny, that you use to describe the way that whiteness, the whiteness gospel works. Can you say more about how the whiteness gospel is like cancer?
Yeah, my friend Jay Lind, who's a musician, and also he just got his residency and has been in med school, was interviewing him for a grad school project where this all kind of arose out of that. And he had been given a grant by Princeton University to spend time with people in hospice, and then write songs about that experience. And as we were talking about these ideas, he said it reminded him of cancer. And cancer is the essential part of cancer is that it says, I'm not part of the body. No, I am the body. And it begins recruiting to that lie. It says cancer is all about unregulated cell growth. And even use the language, it recruits others to its army. So you have this thing within you that says it's not part of you, that refuses to die. And the faster that recruits, the faster it grows, the less likely the actual living being has a chance to live. And so this whiteness gospel, this colonial gospel, as it permeates the world, just replicating that metastasizing lie, again, insatiable, right? Oh, we got to start over again. We lost the purity. We got to start over again. Now it's called this. Now it's called this. It, Baldwin writes about, you know, all of the resources go to the lie. And when all of the light resources are going to the lie and to the pretense, none of the energy, everybody's exhausted, too exhausted to do the real work. And so, yeah, in this way that I just kept joining things that had split, you know, again, chapter one, it feels important to say, like, it's called it's incurable and I've got it. Like, I don't see myself as outside of this. The hospice call is to say, let's get back into the body so that we can die and let it go, but let's do it together and hold each other's hands as we do that. So, yeah, just stop believing the lie that we're not part of the body. And what that's literally doing to the earth and the planet is cancerous.
Yeah. Yeah, you use that metaphor. So kind of this medical metaphor of cancer and hospice care is used throughout the book. And you use hospice care as a metaphor for the spirituality that you say is needed right now for the white American church. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it was in the intro of the book, you say something like Jesus isn't coming to heal this. He's coming to let it die because he loves us, or something like that.
The Lazarus story. So he says about not going to Bethany, I'm not going to heal him because I love him. I'm not going because I love them. And I think we're at that kind of moment where it's more merciful for Jesus to let this way of being die. Daniel Berrigan, I can't get the exact quote, but this, you know, incredible Jesuit priest, peace worker, peacemaker, he wrote about how great it would be if there was just a generation where Christians couldn't talk. because the Christianity that would exist in the next generation, whatever would arise, even if it was called Christianity, would be healthier than what we've got. And I think the death hospice approach to it, for me, I would say, like, I thought I was deconstructing in all of those. And there were parts I was leaving behind, but I kept reconstructing the same thing, or became part of it, or was like a Lego in that rebuild. So for me, it's like and then the compassion of letting it die, like within, without, like, there's a solidarity in it if we could all let it go together. And again, hospice isn't just like lay down and die. It's find what life we have left as we let go of it. Could we find each other again? And then could we like redistribute the wealth instead of funding our new sort of desperate attempt at treatment?
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Can you say a bit more about that? Like, what is, the metaphor is really evocative, but what does it entail for us? Like, what kinds of commitments do we need to make to stop propping up, you know, the whiteness gospel, you know, that kind of a thing, and just sort of let it die with dignity, as you're talking about?
I think those four chapter heads, it's Catholic Pentecostals, Here Comes Everybody, which is a James Joyce quote. And it's that salvation is all of us reconciled, not one-off cancerous souls being saved, but the reconciliation, the coming back to the body. So to be inclusive, to let anybody who wants to be together. Dorothy Day writes about anarchy as this freedom to spontaneously collaborate with anybody. The people I know who are the most serious about activism are really welcoming to anybody who wants to work together. I think that Catholic Pentecostal peace, Eucharistic economy, the Dorothy Day quote, somehow the walls expanded, like the Eucharist as our chief practice, that at this table we become reconciled, and that's an economy. That means Acts 2, that we aren't here to possess. We aren't here to accumulate. We're here to spread. The practical implications of this meal are that no one should be hungry. So live into that economy. The third is ecclesial reparations, probably my favorite subtitle. If you've got two coats, don't start a nonprofit. Thank you.
That was pretty good.
Yep. Yeah, right? Like so many white folks, we learn something and it's like, well, let's file the papers. And people have been doing it for hundreds and thousands of years. So to join instead of create something new and to fund, like what, yeah, the wealth that exists and the things we've been through, for that to start going to real, morally serious work in the world is freedom for all of us. And then the last one is Sabbath wonder, architecture and time. I think one of the things we have to let go of is knowing how it ends. I think a key part of whiteness is we always have a map. And to be led by the ground, to be led by the dirt, to know which way grass grows, to come back to earth. And to say, I don't know. We don't know what comes after death. We hope, we believe, you know, we have faith, but like, I don't know. And I think for white folks to step away from certainty, not just like certainty of belief, but like I can control how it ends, and say, I don't know, but if we do it together, I believe it can be healthier and real and freedom for everybody. So yeah, it's like, sadly remarkable that those things would have to be stated in one capacity. Yeah. But yeah, like be together, share, give to those who, you know, who the wealth has been built on their back, stop and quit expanding and restore, and then don't control it. Mm. And that is where we can find one another.
Yeah. So I'm thinking about this cancer metaphor and this hospice metaphor. You know, when someone enters hospice, it's almost like the beginning of the end, right? So when people go into hospice, they typically don't come out, right? Mm-hmm. And our primary way of getting rid of cancer, if we're not going to try to pray the cancer away, we typically have chemotherapy or radiation, right? Which is a very destructive. So it's destroying and death. And I wonder, those of us listening who maybe feel like we are in a marriage where somebody's committed to a gospel of whiteness and they're resistant or petulant, even if you try to bring it up, or they're parents, they're trying to talk to their parents or connect with their parents. Like, what are some maybe ways that you found to move towards people that don't involve radiation?
Yeah, I think it starts. So I think of one of the hospice doctors I got to interview for the project, and he said what they do is they help people get back in their bodies to die. And he said, in hospice care, there are no real emergencies, there's pain mitigation, and a lot of interruptions. So I think it's this. It's the truth. Like, you know, even the beginning of the end, another way to say that maybe would be just acceptance. And so give people the space to believe that everybody's on a journey, to believe everybody, like God, I believe, will accomplish this love in everyone's life and in all of creation. So to make sure, like, we don't take the reins of whiteness, I think of Howard Thurman saying, we don't really know Jesus until we've stood with those whose backs are against the wall. I think the Jesus invitation is, hey, everybody's welcome. We're going to stand over here. People may come, people may not. People may scapegoat you for doing that, but just like, hands open, like, come on, anytime you want to come, but this is where we're standing. We're not excluding you, but then just to listen, like, to everyone. I think every life has to be listened to, and everyone did get somewhere through some experience. So just the deep listening to say, there's pain here. How can we mitigate the pain? How can we be comfortable with interruptions? And how can we, I think obviously the fierce urgency of now is always present. So yes, our backs are against the wall over here with these people. And for this person, you guys know David Dark, right? The mm-hmm. the robot soft exorcism. Do you guys know that concept?
Yeah.
It's like what the tank man in China mm-hmm. says that, you know, he made eye contact with the person in the tank in hopes that the person would get out of the tank so people could talk. So like someone in, you know, the governor in Tennessee, if we could make eye contact, maybe he could step out of the machine that is the GOP in Tennessee. Mm-hmm. And then we could have a conversation for humanity. David's invitation there. I think that's the stand over here, stand in front of the tank and hope that you make eye contact with the person inside.
And now a word from a sponsor. All right, let's get back into our conversation. I think trying to anticipate questions that listeners may have, but also just like cultivating my own questions. And one of the other things that you do with cancer is surgery, right? If it's localized enough and you feel like you can get the cancer without killing the body or taking too much of the body, you might do surgery to remove cancer. But I was just thinking about how one of the impulses I have is to ask you, well, how do we let the whiteness gospel die? Almost like, how do we do surgery to like extract it from our faith? And I feel like, as you're talking, I'm having this realization. It's like, oh, this is why you've got the hospice metaphor. Mm-hmm. It's too metastasized throughout our faith for us to know what is of Christ and what is of whiteness often.
Yes. Yeah.
And so letting it die, I mean, it doesn't necessarily mean, I mean, you still are a priest at a church, you know, now a bishop, which is a fun joke for everybody, right?
Yeah,
for
all of us. It is the best joke. Yeah.
But anyway, so you're clearly not, you haven't revoked your orders. You haven't stopped being a Christian, but there is a necessity in letting this die where we realize it's too far entangled for us to know how to do surgery. And in letting it die, we just trust that there is resurrection on the other side. I mean, the title of your book, right? Unless a seed falls into the ground, this is what Jesus believed as he went towards the cross. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I don't really have a question in there. I think it's just a realization I'm starting to have. So yeah, I don't know if you have any comments on that.
No, I mean, yeah, that's my when I got to ask Willie James Jennings my question to him, he was because of COVID, he could speak to a class I was in because none of us were leaving the house at the time. And I asked him because he's got a poem in After Whiteness, just this beautiful poem. It's in the front page of the book, really like launched this whole thing for me. And it's this poem about the Last Supper and this dream that Jesus is handing the disciples, and they take his dream and it makes them wonder which of their dreams needs to die and which of their dreams will live. And so I asked Jennings, is this thing, this tradition, this white American Christian church, is it already dead? And it's a zombie and it's mindlessly consuming everything in its path, or is it dying? And if it's dying, could it submit to hospice care? And his response was, it's got enough money to pretend it's alive.
Yeah.
And which is just like, let's all just lay down for a week and let that sink in. But I think it's generous to say it's dying. I think that it could very easily be called dead. So to me, the hospice thing is like the most generous, merciful metaphor I can offer for this kind of letting it go, with a very real curiosity of like, is it already gone? And we're just pretending it's alive by throwing money at it. So yeah, I think the funding is like the number one priority, is like, just stop funding it. Like, even if somebody asked me recently, like, should everybody leave the church they're in? It's like, I don't know. I don't know, but they should stop giving money mm-hmm. to one that is perpetuating these lies. So if somebody goes to one that they're aware of that, just don't fund it. And ultimately, like, that will change things. Mm-hmm. If it's not profitable in the good old US, it'll shift. So yeah, defund the clergy, I think is what I'm saying.
On a podcast with three clergy people on it. So, yeah. Yes.
Which I've done my part in defunding in my career decisions.
I'd like to announce my GoFundMe. It's zombiekiller.gofundme.com.
Crossbow.
Maybe to wrap up then, I think you allude to in a sort of lighthearted way, something that I think about a lot, Danny, and I'd love to get your take on it. And I know a number of our listeners are trying to find their way into faith. Some of them are leading in various capacities at local churches. You yourself are a local pastor. Ben and I both are as well. Can you talk about the difficulty of navigating, being in spiritual leadership and trying to reckon with this stuff? What does this shift look like for you practically, and how do you endure? How do you persevere?
I think that for me, I lean heavily into Ignatian spirituality. And one of my favorite stories about St. Ignatius is toward the end of his life, he's being asked, how would you feel if the society ended and your life's work was gone? And his answer was, I would need a few days to be sad. And so for me, it's like, if what we hope resurrects, the dignity of being a human being in the world and what Jesus does for that and announces about God and us in his work, I don't care in 100 years if that's not called St. Mary of Bethany Parish. And if St. Mary's isn't there, I would need a couple days to be sad. You know, like, I've put a lot into this and I really love it and I believe in it. And the movement of the church doesn't need to be called St. Mary's. The movement of the church doesn't need me. The Spirit will do out of these rocks, right? The stones will cry out. So it's not on me. And I think, like, stepping off the wall, believing we're safe because of communion, not because of some detached, you know, emotionless soldier on the wall, is the way back into the communion that hopefully we exist for. So yeah, just like holding it all very loosely. And I think that my introduction into that with Ignatian spirituality, it's called active indifference. I care deeply about this whole thing. I care about my friends who are still in it. You know, I don't want anybody to be harmed, but the call of Jesus is, you know, in every room we're in, ask and notice who has the least power and make sure we are standing with them. And so, yeah, just active indifference, not too concerned or in love with ourselves, and just a willingness to go where we're asked to go in each moment.
That's super helpful. Super helpful for me. And I trust it is for our listeners as well. Folks, the book again is called Unless a Seed Falls to the Ground, Welcoming the Death of the Whiteness Gospel. Danny, it's been lovely to talk with you, and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me. Great to be with you guys.
You know, Matt, the trope, I feel like it's a trope in church leadership. I mean, I heard it like very quickly after I got into like interning at my first church, getting into ministry and leadership in the church, is like seeing how the sausage is made. You familiar with this metaphor?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Like brats?
Yeah, like brats, where, you know, the metaphor is like, you, once you see how the sausage is made, you lose your appetite for sausage or something like that. But anyway, I remember I was thinking about that metaphor as we were talking with Danny, because in a lot of my experiences in the church, that was my experience of like this thing that gets produced that tastes good, right? It's like good preaching, you know, maybe good worship music, a church service, right? This thing that gets produced that seems good. The way that it gets produced, the sausage, you know, the staff meetings and the way that it all gets produced is all like unappetizing.
Yeah.
And like sometimes downright unchristian. And this was just like given to me as the way things are. Like, this is how the sausage is made. Some people don't have an appetite for it, but this is how it works. And I kept thinking about that as I was listening to Danny, because his book is like one of the remarkable things. I didn't get a chance to ask him about this, but one of the things that struck me about his book is how specific and direct he is about his stories. Like, he doesn't name any names. You know, he mentioned that he changed right. Brother Sentry's name. He doesn't name any names. And so it's not like gossip or inappropriate, but it feels like it goes beyond what I'm used to in terms of specificity. Like, he will outline he's like, a bishop invited me to a steak dinner at the most expensive restaurant in Nashville. And he said this to me, and then he said this, and I said this, and he got upset, you know, and he sort of details these conversations and these events in very, you know, he shows us how the sausage is made. Mm. And I was struck by that. I was like, this isn't normal. Normally you smooth out those edges and you kind of make it into like general lessons.
Yeah.
But I was struck by how specific he was. And I can't help but think that it was intentional and effective, actually. The fact it struck me.
Yeah, it struck me too. And it, you know, we've tried to find nooks and crannies online, places on our Gravity Commons where we can share details about things. Sometimes it feels to me like, I mean, you know me, Ben.
I do. That's one thing about me that I know is that I know you.
If there's anything I like to spill, it's the tea.
It's true.
So I don't, but I also realize that about myself, that I often don't have a real good, like, gossip filter.
Right.
That's just not, I don't have that.
Yeah.
I'm like, here's something fun and interesting. You'll want to hear this, you know?
People are like, that is inappropriate.
But I do, but I, so like half the stories in Danny's book, I'm like, oh yeah, I was there for that. Right. Like, you know, I tell the same stories, right. In private, but I often wonder, like, what's the cost of not sharing public stories, you know, especially in this new environment where people are trying to take their agency back and advocating for survivors of abuse and church abuse.
Yes.
And I often think that the more stories are shared about some of the, you know, the whiteness gospel or the supremacist ways of being in the world, the better we'll be equipped to recognize it when it happens to us and oppose it.
Yes.
And so
I think it's super important.
Yeah. So there's a calculus for me then of like, well, you know, do I share the story about a denominational leader gossiping about me and having all kinds of side conversations and then coming at me with accusations based upon that gossip? Do I share that story? Or do I not, you know?
Yeah. I think the reason it struck me is that I think oftentimes in books, you know, a very public form of communication, this is way out, you know, it's out there. We err on the side of not sharing. I think for fear of, I'm just thinking about my own reticence to share. Sometimes I fear reprisals, you know, if the person, you know, I'm not going to name names, but if the person I'm talking about hears what I say, like, are they going to try to get back at me somehow? So I think there's a fear of reprisal. And I think there is a fear of like, am I just gossiping? Is this just to make me look good? You know, am I just sharing this to be salacious? But I think the other aspect of it is what you said, is that like some of my best learning about how whiteness works and how like these authoritarian habits in the church, some of that stuff happened because somebody told a story.
Yeah.
I've told this story before, I think, but like when we were in the midst of sort of an implosion of a ministry at the hands of a very narcissistic leader, one of the things that helped me see what was going on was a big article that had been written about Mark Driscoll, and it, you know, used the word narcissism and, you know, it tried to, you know, outline how that all works and what happens in an organization that's led by a leader who leads like this. And that was part of what helped me, would be like, oh my gosh, I recognize this in this story that somebody else is telling about a leader I've never met. Yes. But it was really helpful to me.
Totally. Totally.
So anyway, for what it's worth, listener, the way that Danny shares in this book is not gossipy. I don't think he's sharing these stories to say, get a load of this guy. I think he's sharing these things to say, here's how it works in the stuff behind the scenes that not very many people know about.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know what I'm thinking about?
What are you thinking about?
I'm thinking about how Christy's not here, so maybe I could tell you a PG-13 joke.
Oh, well. I mean, all of our listeners are still here.
I think I'm giving,
how they, you know.
I'm giving some warning here that this is a PG-13 joke.
All right. So listener, if you're not allowed to listen to PG-13 jokes, you can just shut it off now. There's really nothing more after this. I guarantee.
Hopefully Christy won't hear this either. For some reason, I feel like it's more appropriate to say this when she's not around. Anyway, a man walks into a bar with a guy who's 1 foot tall. And the man goes up to a bar and orders a drink, and the guy who's 1 foot tall runs over to the piano and starts playing. And the bartender says, what's with the 1 foot tall guy? And the man said, oh, there's a genie out front. He's granting wishes. So the bartender hurriedly goes outside and he says, hey, are you the genie? And the genie says, yep. And he says, well, I want $1 million. And the genie snaps his fingers and says, granted. So he walks back in the bar, and there are 1 million ducks everywhere. Just ducks. Filling the bar.
He misheard.
Filling the bar. And the guy looks at the man, and he says, what the heck, man? I said genie for money, and he gave me ducks. And the man says, right? I know. I asked for a 12-inch. What do you think? I just screwed it up. He says, how do you think I feel? I got a 12-inch pianist.
Oh, man. That was PG-13.
Oh, shoot. Pianos are kind of a divisive topic.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Not everybody likes pianos.
The height of the piano player is controversial.
And there is some animal cruelty in this joke. Those ducks were really wedged in that
poor
bar.
Ducks, yeah. 1 million? How big is that bar?
Yeah. Let me jump
right. There are so many reasons that joke was inappropriate, and we just listed some of them.
So. I totally gaffled the punchline. Oh, maybe your brother Aaron can spice this in. Yeah, right? How do you think I feel?
That'll cost us extra. That'll cost us extra. We're going to have to do some editing.
12-inch pianist.
Yep.
Well.
Good enough. Promise our listeners there was nothing more after this. So
okay, that's
we'll
it.
See you next time.
I'm out.
Thanks for joining us for this episode of the Gravity Podcast. If you're finding it helpful, please tell your friends about it. Word of mouth is the best advertising. Ratings and reviews online also help others find the podcast. And don't forget to subscribe so you don't miss an episode. To join discussions about the podcast and lots more, join us in the Gravity Commons. It's free to join, and you can connect with other listeners to the podcast to talk about faith, spirituality, and whatever else comes up. To join, go to gravitycommons.com/community. The Gravity Podcast is produced by Ben Sturkey and Matt Tebby. Aaron Sturkey edits and mixes the podcast. You can check out his mixing, engineering, and production work at aaronsturkey.com. We'd love to hear from you. To record a question or a comment for us, go to gravitycommons.com/message and click Start Recording button. You can also email us at podcast@gravitycommons.com. Catch you next time.